good vibrations.
Welcome to episode 3 of 4 on the second Summer of Love, so-called, of 88. The 35th anniversary is the acid house rave scene in the UK that gave birth to the worldwide explosion in electronic dance music. This is Mark Devlin of Good Vibrations, joined by Dom and Chris of Sheep Farm Podcasts, and also Matt Sergiu of the Occult Beatles and Conspiro Media. In this episode, we discuss Tony Colston Hayter, the Sunrise Raves, tabloid stories exposing LSD in the 60s and ecstasy in the 80s and those parallels, the Sun's groovy acid house t-shirts, Paul Staines, Tony Colston Hayter's PR man, and some of his dodgy connections, there's a surprise, the late Gary Haseman of D-Mob fame, James Palumbo, head honcho of the Ministry of Sound, Guy Ritchie, Jeremy Taylor and Eddie Davenport of the Toffs Balls, D. Ream and Brian Cox, the Leah Betts Ecstasy Affair, the Rettenden Essex Murders, Carl Cox, Lionel Richie, Fatboy Slim, Paul Van Dyke, and assorted gatekeepers of various scenes. It's going to be a busy episode, and we're going into uncharted territory with this one. Stay with us. We're picking up here in 1989, which was the year where the parties went from basically a cottage industry, very small indoor gatherings, shum and all these other nights, to these massive large-scale open-air raves, Sunrise and the like. So the summer of 89 is when we saw that big switch. And this was the point where the posh boys, the toffs, the public school boys, had muscled in on the scene. So prior to this, it was effectively working class, or so we're led to believe, sort of organic, grassroots kind of thing. But by 89 it had become corporate, and you had a lot of Tory sort of public school boys getting in on a scene where they really didn't belong, at least on the surface of it. So one place to start is with Tony Colston Hayter, who is a promoter of the Sunrise Raves. And there was one that they did around the time of the summer solstice in 89, which was absolutely huge. Milton Common near Oxford. This is where Carl Cox played on three decks for the first time as the sun came up, according to the myth and the legend. And that was a really significant event. So Tony Colston Hayter was behind that. So just a bit of background on him. Born in 1965, the son of a university lecturer and solicitor and a gambling addict. And he used much of the fortune he'd accrued from casino wins to finance his moves into the party scene. His first events appeared at Wembley Studios in August of 88 under the brand of Apocalypse Now, go figure. And Colston Hayter invited reporters from ITV's News at 10 along to film the action. This sparked a series of exposés into acid culture from a mainstream media who had previously ignored the movement altogether. So it seems like that was a calculated, deliberate move to get the mainstream masses focusing on this scene. So Colston Hayter, who used to put on parties with his sister, Charlie Colston Hayter, had an associate called Paul Staines, who worked as his publicist. And we're going to bring in Matt here from Conspiro Media, Occult Beatles, and all the rest of it. I think you've got some stuff on this character, Paul Staines, haven't you there?
Oh, yeah, baby, for sure. And with regards to the media and how it picked up on the acid house movement of 88 and plastered it all across the headlines back in 88 to an unsuspecting public, because there are parallels there with the 1960s again and the LSD. For example, in 1966, it was around March 1966, the British tabloid press began to push these stories in the mass media about LSD, sensationalist stories. Now, the thing is, it could be argued that it could have been done deliberately in order to begin the agenda to introduce LSD to the wider world, because in March 1966, I can't speak for the American scene, but certainly from what I've seen, or I've looked at in my research into the British scene, it would appear that in March 66, when these tabloid stories were coming out, sensationalizing LSD, so they were stories basically looking down upon LSD, the new danger drug, you know. But in March 66, I think it's fair to say that in Britain at least, the mass mainstream public weren't aware of LSD. They didn't know about LSD. It was still within the confines of the military, of the intelligence world. There were a few so-called intellectuals, quote unquote, who were taking it, who were kind of linked to that secret world, if you like. And there were some within the underground scene of London, some of the sort of the heads within that scene in London who knew about it and who were taking it. But on a larger scale, when we're talking mass millions, it wasn't a street drug, basically. It wasn't out there, and the mass populace were not aware. They'd never even heard of LSD. So you could say that I think there was three publications back in 1966 who pushed it in March 66. One was the News of the World, the now defunct News of the World. Surprise, surprise. The other one was the Sunday People newspaper, and another one was a magazine called London Life. They were the three that were really pushing it. So you could say that they, one of a cynical nature, might say that they were pushing it to push ahead the agenda that was to follow with the Summer of Love in 1967. Now, in 1988, you could argue that the same thing happened again with the acid house culture. Mark, you touched on it there. I've got one example here, right, from October 1988, October 12th, 1988. And I've done a printout of this.
Aleister Crowley's birthday.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't help noticing.
Oh, yeah. Good one. Now, this appeared in the Sun newspaper. So, again, we're talking about tabloid press, Britain's best-selling newspaper at the time. It's a relative of, it's connected to the News of the World as well, if I'm not mistaken. It's within the same ownership. And there was a page, I don't know if you guys remember it back then, and it was a page in the paper every day, and it was called Bizarre. And basically, mm-hmm. It was a one or two page spread where they'd look at pop gossip, music gossip. And in this particular edition on October the 12th, they dedicate pretty much the whole page, if I'm not mistaken, to this new horror drug, this new horror scene, acid music and LSD and acid house and all the rest of it. Now, as far as I'm aware, if they hadn't have done that, again, it could be argued that people like my parents, for example, and of their generation would never have known what acid house was. Because as I recall it, growing up in the 80s and being 18, 19 when this all kicked off, I found out about it from not only being a DJ at the time, but because my friends were of a similar age and ripe for it. So we were into that kind of music. We were open to taking that music in.
And Matt, but I recall that October of 88 is when that D-Mob tune was released. We call it Acid, the sort of unofficial.
All right, anthem. Yeah. So, okay, so here's the weird juxtaposition, if you like, of this piece from October 12th, 1988. It's got a list, and it's got a list for its readers under the heading 10 Reasons to Say No to Evil LSD. Okay, so you get a list telling you why you shouldn't touch it. But the main headline of the story is, it's groovy and cool. It's our acid house T-shirt, only £5.50, man. So they're already going in with the 60s. So not only are they selling acid house to the unsuspecting general public, the millions and millions of people who used to read this newspaper who would never have been aware of it otherwise, but they're already going for the 1960s thing by saying groovy, cool, and all of that stuff. So, hey man, have we got a groovy offer for you? Trend setting t-shirts to help you keep way ahead of Britain's latest dance craze, acid house. Everyone is talking about acid, as it's known in the clubs. The t-shirts look great with essential acid house gear, like a smiley faced headscarf, £3.99, bandanas, £2.99, and cycling shorts. Remember them? My girlfriend used to wear those. £25.99 from the hip store Fans in London's Soho. So, yeah, with that as the backdrop, basically going back to Paul Staines and Tony Causton Hayter, there was the official narrative, okay, the story that we're given is, and I think this is according to Paul Staines, actually, who was interviewed about it. What happened was, Tony Causton Hayter was getting really stressed out by these negative press stories that were doing the rounds in the tabloid press. And he felt like he was getting hassled by the press. He didn't know how to handle it. He didn't know how to get out of it, how to deal with the mainstream media. So basically what he did is he got in touch with Paul Staines and asked him what he could do. And Paul said, well, okay, I'll be your PR man. So basically that's what he became. He became Sunrise's PR man. So he was there to take statements for the press, to give comments to the press, to the newspapers, to the TV, and so on and so on. But yeah, when you look at Paul Staines's background, my God, at the time that he was working for Sunrise and he was the PR man for this anti-establishment, you know, stick it to the man organization, these parties, he was working for a guy that was connected to a very fluid world that was mixed. It was a world of intelligence, military, British politics. The guy he was working for, he was basically like an assistant, if you like, a right-hand man for a guy by the name of David Hart. David Hart was a banking heir. He made his fortune initially in property. And in the late 70s and early 80s, I think he was very involved in the miners' strike of 83 and 84. Anyone remembers that from the 80s in Great Britain? He was very much central to what was going on within the miners' strike at the time. He was advising Margaret Thatcher on that. And then later on in the 90s, he was appointed special advisor at Britain's Ministry of Defence for the then Secretary of State for Defence, Malcolm Rifkin. And he was also, so I'm led to understand, a quote unquote middleman for a number of defence contractors. So this is who David Hart, this is who Paul Staines was working for in 89.
You have to say as well, Matt, that if you're in the defence industry, you do come under the radar of intelligence agencies.
Well,
you have to.
Yeah, well, I'm getting to that. So I've got some juicy quotes here from Paul Staines. Of his time with working with David Hart in the late 1980s, Paul Staines has said, "It was bloody exciting. We were involved with the kind of anti-communist rebels Ronald Reagan's people were pushing. I'm still pretty gung-ho. We were on the right side of history. I don't have any problem with having raised money to kill communists." Additionally, he's also said, "I was an anarcho-capitalist. I was lobbying at the Council of Europe and at Parliament. I was over in Washington, in Johannesburg, in South America. It was, let's get guns for the Contras, that sort of stuff. I was enjoying it immensely. I got to go with these guys and fire off AK-47s. I always like to go where the action is. And for that period in the Reagan-Thatcher days, it was great fun. It was all expenses paid and I got to see the world." Now, with regards to the intelligence community, here's something that I actually took from his blog. Incidentally, Paul Staines is now known as a political blogger. He goes by the name of Guido Fawkes, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's how you pronounce it. But yeah, on his blog, he put this up, and with regards to intelligence, secret intelligence, in the late 1980s, I ran the London office of the IGFM, or the International Society for Human Rights, a German headquartered group which focused heavily on helping the victims of communism. Apparently, according to various left-wing publications, we were a front for the CIA. If we were, they certainly got their money's worth. Partly because of my background in this world, David Hart, the Maverick Thatcher confidant and fixer, hired me as a foreign policy advisor. One day in October 1989, Hart summoned me to his adjoining office and said to me, "You speak German, don't you, Paul? Okay, well, I want you to go to East Berlin and find out what's really going on, because Margaret Thatcher doesn't trust the Foreign Office reports." So it was that I found myself on a flight to Frankfurt the next day, equipped only with schoolboy German and with instructions to hook up with one of Hart's contacts in Berlin. In Frankfurt, I bumped into someone I knew vaguely via IGFM, an American who wanted to come with me to Berlin. He wore a trench coat and could not have looked more like a CIA agent if he had tried. Now, with regards to David Hart, he is reported to have worked closely in the 1980s with former head CIA honcho director William Casey. And additionally, there's a couple of journals, as they're called, that Hart was responsible for, that he published, that he financed. Right. One was called World Briefing, and I think the other one was actually called, yeah, it's called British Briefing. And essentially what this journal was, this British Briefing, it was a once monthly news journal that went out. And a former CIA agent by the name of Herb Mayer had edited it for a time, as had former MI5 officer Charles Elwell, and also Brian Crozier, who'd worked both with the CIA and MI6. And somewhere along the line, Paul Staines helped to produce it as well. Now, to round this off, just to conclude it, whilst Staines was PR man for Sunrise, the office where he was running the PR operations from was in David Hart's office within his building.
Yeah. I mentioned Paul Staines in Musical Truth Volume 2, actually. And there's a quote here I've got from an article in The Guardian about Tony Colston-Hayter and his parties. And the quote is, "Some members of the government were dismayed that their opponents weren't pierced and dreadlocked outsiders, but well-spoken right-wing entrepreneurs who stashed their profits in an offshore tax haven. A baffled Home Office official once screamed at Staines, 'You're a right-wing Tory. Why are you doing this?' And I feel that's a pretty good question."
Sounds like a lot of the characters involved in the 60s, doesn't it? You know, the Quentel Pro type characters that grew their hair long and infiltrated Manson and all this other stuff, and the Operation Chaos by the CIA.
And the other parallel with the 60s is, in the 60s, you had a lot of aristocrats, you know, young descendants of aristocratic families mixing in with the likes of the Beatles and the Stones and the whole acid culture, getting involved in the publication of underground magazines, getting involved in the promotion of events, you know, live events, and making music videos and documentaries and all that kind of thing. So again, there's another parallel there. You know, you have all these so-called toffs, these blue bloods getting involved, not only in the 60s scene, but also, again, you've got it in the 80s scene again. Again, another parallel.
Go to university, get a degree, and end up pushing drugs and hanging out at acid house parties. Natural career progression.
I think it's probably more than that, Mark. I think there's some kind of Prometheus line going through these people that for some reason they seem to get chosen. Because, I mean, millions of people go to universities, but not everybody becomes that creme de la creme, do they? There is a choosing somewhere, following, going back to what Christian said about, I keep saying this, but Omen with Damien, when he met the sergeant. So it's like that, like they've been followed. Some of these people I don't think know they're being used. I think, like Operation Mockingbird, most of these news journalists were recruited unknowingly. But a lot of them do know they're being used and they're part of the machine and the planning.
One thing I noticed when Matt was talking, I was literally, I realised actually as he was talking, that I was right at that propagandised age, because I was 15, just leaving school. I remember D-Mob coming out with Acid. And my mum and dad used to have the News of the World. And I'm pretty sure I remember feeling I wanted to be part of this movement, whatever it was. And it worked because, like you said, I just found out about it because I'd heard that song, seen it on the news, seen it in the News of the World. And then I think I was like 15, I was 15 in 89. And I think I did some acid when I was like 16. So I was literally programmed by that movement.
It could be argued that had not the Sun pushed it in October 88, like it did with that piece, most of the country would never have known about it, and it would have remained an underground club scene.
Doing that classic as well. It's a horror show, but we're going to sell you a T-shirt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And talking about the D-Mob record, it featured Gary Haseman, who's the guy that popularised the acid scream. He died in 2018 after some health complications. We were talking in the pre-show emails about a quote from Gary Haseman, which you seem to recall, Matt, but we can't place it, where he was saying he wouldn't be surprised if the whole acid house scene was a psyop. And I dug out an article from Mixmag concerning the single eye image that was used on one of Paul Oakenfold's club flyers for his future brand. And that came from Gary Haseman. And according to Mixmag, One of the most iconic pieces of UK house artwork was conceived by Haseman, the Dave Little design flyer for Spectrum. And Dave Little said, "The eyeball was totally Gary's idea. I want a big fucking eye in the middle, Dave," he said. "Graphically, I came up with the rest of it. Looking at it now, I think it stands the test of time." So interesting that Haseman wanted the single eye, you know, the symbolism there, and he's no longer around to tell the tale. But if he was, who knows what he would say?
I would say that that's how it works. I think we've discussed this before, that he only needs one guy just to suggest using an eye, and then that guy's done it. He's drawn the eye. And it's there.
Yeah. And that was another throwback to the 60s. It was a design from some Grateful Dead artwork that was reused in the 80s.
Round and around it goes, round and around. What about James Palumbo? Does anyone want to mention James Palumbo?
I've got a bit of detail on James if you want me to go
sure.
into
yeah, Jamie. Head honcho of the Ministry of Sound.
Of the Dysentery of Sound, yeah.
Another blue blood, seemingly.
Well, I mean, we know he's a Baron, the Baron of Southwark, born 6th of June, 1963. What six is there? British entrepreneur, estimated fortune of 300 million. So just started organically, did the Ministry of Sound. His grandfather was Rudolf Palumbo, a British property tycoon, stroke developer, who made a fortune redeveloping bomb sites after World War II. The company was called Acre City Acre, and I think City Acre now is a trust fund. I looked on company's house, and there's a trust fund there under City Acre with a board of trustees, etc., which I presume is what our friend Jamie there lives from. He also built his headquarters, and they turned it into a private members club in 2000 called the Walbrook Club, and it's next door to the Bank of England and Mansion House, just by accident, obviously. And the first chairman was Rupert Hambro, who was head of the Hambro Bank. It was a massive banking dynasty, the Hambro Bank. Everyone will have heard of Hambro Bank. And during World War II, Sir Charles Hambro was head of the Special Operations Executive. Anyway, so this chap's son, and Jamie's granddad, Peter Palumbo, was also a baron. He was a baron. He's still alive now. He's a property developer, art collector, conservative member of the House of Lords, trustee of the Tate Gallery, chairman of the Tate Gallery Foundation. He served at the Whitechapel Art Gallery, the Natural History Museum. He was a chairman of the Serpentine Gallery, Board of Trustees. I think Princess Diana was something to do with that as well. Or there's a building there named after her. And Margaret Thatcher appointed him chairman of the Arts Council of Great Britain. So Jamie Palumbo isn't as organic as we thought, where he set his Ministry of Sound up and then became a baron. His cousin also is a chap called Lionel Nicholas Richard Wigram. He's a British film producer and screenwriter. And he was also senior vice president of Warner Brothers. And as a studio executive, he was responsible for buying the Harry Potter series as well and putting that through onto film. And he also started a production company with our friend Guy Ritchie. Right. So he's in business with Guy Ritchie, the Ritchie Wigram Productions, it's called. And incidentally, I did some lineage on Guy Ritchie a while ago, and his lineage goes back to King Henry VII via the Plantagenet family, which is an ancient French family. And then we've got Madonna, who's a distant cousin of Camilla Barker Bowles as well. So, yeah, obviously.
Yes, he's some kind of planted director, is Guy Ritchie. He has to be, because he went from those couple of gangster films to Disney. And I think he's just made some kind of propaganda war film, I think. I can't remember what it's called. So I've always been a bit suspicious of his career as a director. And then marries Madonna as well.
Yeah. That might have been a punishment. But also, Jamie's father, Peter Palumbo, was a polo teammate of King Charles Sausage Fingers III. And he's also godfather to Princess Beatrice of York, the eldest daughter of the Duke of York. Oh, yeah. Shall I go on, or do we just...
Isn't it interesting that the Ministry of Sound, and what's in a name, Ministry, it sounds like a government department, right?
Yeah.
Headed up by Palumbo. was infested with drugs in its early days. It was very notorious for being a haven for all sorts of drug dealers and gangsters and stuff. And they're referred to as drug barons. And it's owned by Palumbo, who is actually a baron. But I've got some more here about Palumbo and the ministry being used as to push drugs. Working with police, Palumbo claimed to have eventually driven the dealers out and boasted that Ministry was the only drug-free club in Britain. In keeping with its cleaned-up image, he struck up an alliance with Tom Sackville, the Home Office Minister responsible for club licensing. Palumbo recalls that the resulting legislation gave the police summary powers to close drug-infested venues. Ministry of Sound was cited in the parliamentary debate as an example of best practice. So it would appear as if part of its mission was to get other undesirable clubs closed down where there were dealers operating without approval, shall we say. And it was there to kind of police the other operatives in the scene, which might be why it was set up in the first place.
In business, it's called consolidating.
It's called lots of things.
Consolidate the businesses. They get rid of all the crap. Amazon have done it. Get rid of all the online businesses, small online, and just take over. The supermarkets did it with the corner shops. It's the same principle. The breweries did it with the local pubs, et cetera, et cetera.
And this was part of getting the parties out of the fields, these open-air raves, where a lot of gangsters were muscling in, into indoor licensed venues where they could be closely monitored and approved and kept an eye on. That seems to have been the process that took place in the 90s.
Or even someone just opening a tin pot version of a club could instantly be shut down.
Even the doorman, I had mates, one guy, he had muscle on tap, he had 300 doormen working for him at one point, running bars and pubs and basically rave clubs. And they went through a process where you just had a load of gorillas on the door, and then you had to go through a government training to get a badge, or you couldn't be a doorman, which did have its benefits. You weren't getting dead arms and stuff like that as you walked in. But also, that put them under the control then of the council. It changed. So that's another part of the side of it that changed.
Licenses for everything.
Yeah, it sure is.
And Ministry started busing in doormen from Birmingham because no doorman in London would work at that place because the reputation was so bad at one point.
Yeah, it didn't surprise me. I think a lot of that happened in doors where they brought people from outside in because they were unaware of the dangers stroke. They didn't have any loyalties to the local hoodlums either.
Yeah. Well, what year was Ministry Sound set up? Just out of interest, I forgot.
Well, it was opened on the autumn equinox of 1991.
Right.
Nothing occult about that.
All that stuff happened very rapidly, didn't it? When you think about years going by, that's 3 years. And then they just opened that super club.
And it's still going.
It's
about the only one that survived in London all that time.
Yeah, there's not many that survived, have there, that's carried on?
Not many. All those big brands, Cream, Gatecrasher, Renaissance, Miss Moneypenny's, all of these, they came and went, but that one stayed.
I went a few years ago, actually, to see a soul DJ. It was quite good.
Not Ministry?
Yeah, it wasn't a rave, obviously. Who's that? Who's that BBC soul DJ?
Trevor Nelson.
He was playing.
Yeah, I played there a few times, Ministry, in Room 2.
Yeah, it was good. Although I did think I could have done that. I had every record he played.
you sound like
you're
a
not
DJ.
An MBE, Chris.
Wrong bloodline, Chris.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just one other thing with regards to the Toffs and the public schoolboys muscling in on the act. Just wanted to mention Jeremy Taylor, who staged the Gatecrasher Balls, not connected to the Gatecrasher brand out of Sheffield, but these were known informally as the Teenage Toffs Balls, put on in the late 1980s at country estates like Longleat and Weston Park and a few in central London. And the idea was to allow public school boarders to party alongside members of the opposite sex. Of course, these days there's like 72 genders, but back in the late 80s there were just two. Taylor's co-organizer was Fast Eddie Davenport, better known within aristocratic realms as Lord Edward Davenport. a socialite and property developer. Here we go again. He was also a convicted fraudster, receiving a 7-year jail sentence in 2011 for his part in a series of schemes that had conned millions of pounds out of his victims. And talking about Tony Colston Hayter as we were, I see that he served 2 jail terms for robbery and fraud. So
I think he's in jail at the moment. I'm not exactly sure what for. It's something to do with banking again. But as we speak, he's currently in jail. He's gone back in again.
Right. Yeah. Great characters. What could possibly go wrong?
I think a lot of these, like we said, just saying earlier, though, I think a lot of these people were probably used because obviously that they have people come in to work with them, like the character you were talking about there, Matt. And they're behind them, behind the scenes, then they've got somebody behind them who's close to the establishment, let's say. And it's so far away from what's actually happening. Nobody really knows. It's compartmentalized, isn't it? Nobody really knows what's going on, because even the chap that was working with this guy we were just on about there, Mr. Hayter, the guy that was working with him, what were he called?
Staines. Yeah.
He probably doesn't know the full picture of what was going on until afterwards, and it's too late then, isn't it? You can't back out, because they just pull the rug on your whole career. That's what seems to happen to this guy.
Was Staines a compulsive gambler, man?
I think he...
Is that the gambling guy? He said he had a gambling addiction.
Colston Hayter was the gambler.
Yeah, he was a gambler. Mm. Well, yeah. Immediately just think compromise, because how easy is it to compromise?
Yeah. According to the official story, the official narrative, if it's true or not, I don't know. But apparently, Hayter and Staines met as teenagers in a video games competition or something.
Yeah.
And they had like a mutual love of video games at a young age, and then they forged a friendship or whatever. I think that's how they met. But
again, how them things are set up there. Let's just say they were friends when they were young. Then all of a sudden, Staines is working for somebody who's working for the MI6. And they say, we need to get into this dance culture because blah, blah, blah. This is the new plan for the next 25 years. Do you know anybody? And he said, well, as it happened, a friend of mine is just setting this, well, you need to get back friendly with him type of thing. And we need to get, and this is how these things work, don't they? We've got a hold on you because you've got a debt. I'm not saying this happened, but this is how it works. And so he might not want it to do it, but, and also he thinks he's benefiting his friend by pushing his business. Anyway.
Just one more thing on Palumbo before we move on from him. He was a close associate of Tony Blair's Labour Party kingpin, Lord Peter Mandelson, Prince of Darkness, known to holiday at the Corfu home of Baron Jacob Rothschild. And Palumbo is reported to have given Mandelson the use of a chauffeur-driven car for the 1997 general election campaign. So there's another connection into the establishment. And of course, the theme tune for Labour's 1997 election campaign was Things Can Only Get Better. Spoiler alert, they didn't. By Dee Ream, the keyboardist for whom was... Anyone?
Oh, friend.
Cockend.
Yeah, Cockend. Cockend.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. The scientist bloke, the space bloke. Can't remember his name.
He knows everything about everything that happened 4 billion years ago.
Yeah. He's got a graph. That's it. He's got a graph for everything. He pulls a graph out of his pocket every time.
I forgot about Pocky that, stick. Matt. Then it was the theme tune for Labour as well. Bloody hell.
Yeah. D Ream. And we won't go into what reaming is on this show. We'll save that for next time. Maybe we should move on to the Leah Betts affair. We've been talking about ecstasy and how this was everywhere in clubland in the 90s, in the early 90s and beyond, of course. And so in November 1995, teenager Leah Betts from Essex collapsed and died after necking a single ecstasy tablet at her 18th birthday party. I think she was the daughter of a police officer, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. I think he'd retired by then.
I remember that happening at the time, and one of the things I always thought was, because if you remember, they went after the drug dealer. That was the most important thing, was they need to find the guy who sold her that E, because she was 18, and he was the first ever one, apparently. But I remember thinking at the time, why go after, if someone runs over someone in a car and they're speeding, you don't go after the car dealership, do you? Or the guy who manufactured the car, or who made the car.
Or sold it.
Anyway, those people. I mean, it was a horrible thing that happened, but it was like a frenzy to go after the drug dealer, if I remember rightly.
But again, we were talking about this, Chris, and during that time, they were saying that you need to drink loads of water. If, in the papers,
yeah,
they were telling you to drink loads of water.
Because
you're dehydrated.
People would die from dehydration.
Yeah.
And they turned all the taps off in the clubs. So then they could sell water because they weren't selling any booze to people taking drugs.
Yeah.
So therefore, they had to sell water and soft drinks. So they turned all the taps off. I remember that. I remember drinking warm water out of the tap because there was no bloody cold.
Sure, it was warm.
Yeah, working a bit out. Yeah, but
she drowned. The fluoride in the water will.
Yeah, take loads of fluoride down there. Yeah, she died, like you said. In fact, she died of I think she drowned, didn't she? I think she drank too much water.
Well yeah, it's interesting and sad. The poor girl passed away, but she died from water intoxication apparently. Hypnotremia, which is basically leads to the swelling of the brain by drinking. I think it said that she drank approximately 7 liters of water, which is in a very short space of time, 4 hours type of thing.
Yeah.
She collapsed in a coma afterwards. The interesting part of this, I found that although a death, again, in the News of the World and Sun and etc., they had a picture on a bed with the tubes in her. And you know, other things that happen, they always say we can't show these pictures because it's too raw and all this. Yet certain things get plastered all over the picture that are just as bad as the things that they're saying they can't show. And she was on every newspaper, front of every newspaper. I don't read newspapers now, but I did then. Well, always the fact, constantly on the news.
The fact that we all still remember her name, they say something.
Yeah. And apparently they were saying that ecstasy tablets may have reduced her ability to urinate. So not only did she drink too much water, but she couldn't get rid of the excess water. Now, whether this is true or not, I don't know. But the interesting thing was the toxicologist, I thought, the government toxicologist who was telling all this stuff at the inquest, a guy called John Henry, he'd warned about the dangers of MDMA causing death by dehydration. And he said if Leah took the drug alone, she might well have survived. A lot of wells and mites here. If she had drunk the amount of water alone, she would have survived. So he's leaving sort of an open end saying both together made it into some kind of weapon. But he was, his background, he was a toxicologist at the Imperial College of London. And he did research on the effects of cannabis, cocaine, and all the other recreational drugs. So he is actually the government spokesman for all this, and he was doing experiments on these drugs at the same time. And lo and behold, they wheel him out at Leah Betts's.
Just after they've told everyone to drink more water, now they're saying drink less water.
But his background, as a 20-year-old medical student, Henry was a member of Opus Dei.
Here we go.
Yeah, here we go. Obviously, Opus Dei is known as the prelature of the Holy Cross and Opus Dei. And in 1990, there was a revelation about it being part of Operation Gladio in Italy. They were the ones bombing railway stations. And so they were part of the Gladio network. And obviously, then some researchers were attached to secret MI6 and like Le Cercle. I don't know if you've heard of Le Cercle. Le Cercle's a secret group that was set up by the French intelligence after World War II, and then the British intelligence have taken over it. And all the chairmen in the past, I'll just name a few of these chairmen who've been chairman of Le Cercle. Jonathan Aitken, who was an arms dealer, and he worked for Marconi, and he was a part of MI6. Baron Norman Lamont, who worked for the Rothschilds banking company before he got into politics. The 13th Marquess Lothian, Baron Kerr, Michael Ancram, MP. Also, MP Rory Stewart, OBE, who was a young global leader in 2008, member of the Trilateral Commission, CFR, and named as a MI6 agent by a reporter called Craig Murray, who was also a diplomat, whistleblower. So, and the last two, interestingly, have been Nadeem Zahawi, whose grandfather was governor of the Central Bank of Iraq, Nadeem Zahawi, and crazy Kwasi Kwarteng, who was also funded by Le Cercle to go on trips to America and things like this before he got into politics. So, and while he was an MP as well. So Le Cercle and Opus Dei go hand in hand.
The good news is, Dom, you dissolve the Le Cercle by just saying it in a northern accent.
Yeah, no. Le Cercle.
He just loses his clout for some reason.
It's actually spelled
Le Cercle.
Circle, I should have said. But yeah, so again, it's interesting when you look at the background of some of these people who were involved in these events that happen. And behind Leah Betts, you've got Opus Dei, who were part of Operation Gladio. And then you have to ask yourself, was that part of this process? Where did these ecstasy tablets come from originally? Is it the same part of this world that we're looking into, isn't it?
Like I said, they go after that dealer who apparently killed Leah Betts. But where did he get them from? Who let him into the country? They're going after a tin pot dealer in a nightclub or wherever. But they're not. No one ever focused on... Every now and again, they'd say we had a drug bust and we got 10 grand's worth of ease. But that was kind of it, wasn't it? And it still is. You don't hear anything about any big dealers getting caught, do you?
It's a story that they wanted out there, isn't it? Because other kids have died, sadly, from taking ecstasy. But Leah Betts is the only one you remember. It's like loads of kids go missing every single year, as we know. But Madeleine McCann is the only one that people remember. Yeah. So there's a reason why they want these particular stories.
What is it, 8 million a year?
Circumstances out there.
8 million kids a year.
Something ridiculous.
Yeah.
She focused on that one picture of that one kid, like Dom said, that one picture of her with all the tubes sticking out of her head. That was what was used to sell them.
But one of the things that led into this were always around that time in 1995 was the Rettenden murders. Can you remember the guys, the Essex boys?
Yeah.
They were linked to having supplied the drug in the club because I think one of them run the door of the club where she went and died. These guys ended up in December of 1995 being killed in a Range Rover, three of them.
Now, I remember that.
Whether it was anything to do with that or not, it's quite an interesting link because they then set off, I think, the rise in... There's about 10 films made about that. All these gangster films that were brought out, going back to Guy Ritchie, coming from nowhere.
London gangster.
You've got all these
story.
Rise of the Foot Soldier, Essex Boys, The Fall of the Essex
Fairbrass
Boys.
Craig Fairbrass was in that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah. And a lot of these...
Danny Dyer's in all of them.
Danny dies in every one of them. Yeah. Even if he's not acting, he's one at Tyres on Car. Yeah.
Danny Tyre,
yeah.
Boom, boom.
But that explosion then of all these British gangland films.
But also you're programming people, because I've had so many people, have you seen Essex Boys? No, I haven't. Oh, it's brilliant. You know, because you're inspiring the youth to go down that road of plastic gangster, drug dealer kind of thing. Mm. You know. Yeah. Finding more horror in the Reds.
But I mean, there's a bigger story to these murders, I'm sure. There was an operation called Operation Century that was to look for the perpetrators of these three people that were killed. Bear in mind, there were trouble causes in the local area, these guys. So it is quite an interesting story. But again, it's blown up out. How many people who were involved in taking ease get knocked off or drugs in a year, you know? Is it that big of a story, really? Really? Yeah. Sounds cool, but to have 10 films made after you, I think Sean Bean were in one of them.
Yeah, the plan, that story is out there for a reason, isn't it? That Essex Boys story.
So, I mean, I know it's drifting away from music, but the film side of it is just because they use all the music in the films.
Mm. Yeah. So there was this TV experiment where the audience was invited to try ecstasy live in the show. I don't know what the time scale was for this.
2012,
Snow,
I think
it was. Hosted there?
Yeah. I'm not aware of it, but I can certainly give you another 60s parallel because it happened in the 50s, I think it was. I think it was a Brit. My memory's playing tricks on me. You can actually find this on YouTube, I think, or parts of it. It was either in the 50s or the very early 60s. They filmed a British member of Parliament, I think it was, or he had something to do with it, taking LSD, and then they filmed him and watched what the effects were, and then after an hour or two or three or however long it was, they asked him, how are you feeling? And he was pretty spaced out.
Better than Frank Olson?
Yeah, not as horrific as Frank Olson.
Yeah,
certainly. This has been done again. You know, this has been done before. You know, it's one of those tried and tested kind of media sort of tricks, if
and,
you like.
And you said Jon Snow was the producer, not producer. But...
Did that note come from you, Dom? Somebody mentioned this TV show hosted by Jon Snow, is it, or Peter Snow? I'll get them confused.
Yeah, it would Jon Snow, and Peter Snow is his cousin, and then Dan Snow is the son of Peter Snow. Dan Snow's married into the... He's a history sort of journalist, isn't he now?
Yeah.
But he's married into the Grosvenor family are worth, I think, $12 billion on the Times Rich List this year. The Duke... Is it the Duke of Mayfair? Not Mayfair, Westminster. And they're up here in... Duke of Cheshire and whatever. Anyway, Chester, that's it. And he's also the great-great-great-grandson of Earl Baron David Lloyd George, is Dan Snow. So when you're seeing Dan Snow presenting all these history programs, I know we're drifting again, but he's not just Dan Snow, the nice chap in front of it. He's rewriting history or telling history how it should be. And one thing you can see with history, because I was interested in World War II, when you see history programs or read a history book about World War II was when it was written just after the war, it is totally different to the books that are written now or the programs you see now. Every time a new journalist comes out, it gets watered down again. And music's the same, isn't it? They water it down. All art's probably the same. Chris, you're into art and what have you.
Well, I was saying to you the other week, Dom, this actually does have some relevance because I caught a bit of Kelly's Heroes on TV, you know, the Clint Eastwood war film. And I was saying to Dom that I was counting out that, I think that was made in 1970. And in that, the Germans still had some, what's the word?
Credibility.
They weren't as nasty as what they are now, if you know what I mean. The old Nazi thing. They weren't quite as nasty. They were still gentlemen in a kind of way. They were still having a war. And that was 1970. So it's not long after the Second World War actually happened. And what I noticed as well in that, just as irrelevant, is because I watched it just after we did the first one. Who is it? Donald Sutherland's in it. And bearing in mind, it's meant to be 1945 or whatever. And they've given him a hippie vibe because it was made in the 70s. So he's still like, yeah, man. Yeah, and you're like, but that it was supposed to be 1945 because it was made in 70s. They were still using him as like this hippie throwback.
To get the younger audience to go. Yeah.
But I thought, what a strange thing. You know, he literally talked like hippie, had a big beard. Oh, yeah, man. Anyway, sorry, odd.
But Kiefer Sutherland and Donald Sutherland, lineage goes back to Robert II, King of France and Scotland. So there you go.
How could it not?
How could it not?
Might as well, mate.
Might as well, yeah.
So yeah, I don't recall this MDMA TV thing. When was it?
2012 it was. 2012. And what they did was they got some people on there and basically off their heads on ease. Well, live on the show.
What were they doing? Sitting down? Were they
sitting down? Dull? Yeah, doing all sorts of stuff with them, and it was just a television experiment.
Ecstasy. The debate continues tonight. More breakthrough science in our unprecedented human trial of one of the most controversial drugs. Does ecstasy kill, or could it cure? Plus, an XMP and the actor Keith Allen on a specially prepared 83 milligram dose. Good evening. Last night, eminent scientists Professor David Nutt from Imperial College London and Professor Val Curran from University College London revealed some astonishing science about how ecstasy affects the brain.
Tonight, we take that into the real world. We'll reveal what actually is in the pills sold at Glastonbury. Was it really ecstasy or just talcum powder? Or something much worse. We'll see if ecstasy could help treat depression and post-traumatic stress. There'll be intense debate between Professor Nutt and his scientific opponents on just how harmful ecstasy is and what happened to the brains of former MP Evan Harris and actor Keith Allen when they entered the scanner.
Yeah, a bit like they did to the military guys in the 50s where they give them all LSD and took them out on a patrol and they're all laughing their heads off.
That was 1964.
Porton Down, lovely place.
Nice.
Great energy there.
Friendly place. Yeah.
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 There's a few DJs I wanted to mention from this all important era. One of them we touched on in the last show is Carl Cox. CC, as in 3-3, maybe. But for some reason, Carl Cox became, or has become, pretty much the highest paid DJ in the world. From very humble beginnings, he used to play soul, funk, and disco, as did so many of these other DJs before he got into techno and hard house and became an ambassador for electronic dance music. So there's some very suspect symbolism in the logo that he now uses, the Vector logo, which looks like a winged sun disk out of Egyptian mythology, possibly giving a hint to his affiliations. And very early on, 1995, he was pushing transhumanism, effectively. He'd become a chosen one, it seems, by that point. And he put out a landmark album called Future Alliance of Communication and Technology Fact, which just sounds like AI, effectively. And when you look at the symbolism that he pushes these days and the events that he plays at, it's just pushing transhumanism and AI. And he would appear to be their man for the job. And he cropped up in the Scamdemic narrative when he made a video endorsing the use of the arm spears. And he was saying to young clubbers, come on, guys, the only way we're going to get Clubland back and get these festivals going again is if everyone goes out and takes the three dart finish. I wonder if he did himself.
My whole life existence over the last 30 years has been entertaining people in small clubs, in bars and wine bars and big clubs and festivals alike. What I do, it creates a gathering of people. So that's what I'd like to see happen more than anything, that we can basically all be safe in knowing that we're going out to party safe and enjoy ourselves.
So, Carl, what would you say to anyone who's currently considering not taking the vaccine or just hasn't got around to it yet?
We are in a pandemic. This is something that we are all trying to deal with and all trying to work on. And what we don't want is the clubs to not work. In the end of the day, we're all on the front line now. So this is the only thing we can do to protect ourselves, to be able to enjoy our moments.
People who have had both their jabs are far less likely to catch COVID. The severity of their symptoms are likely to be much less severe, less serious, and the chances of them being admitted to hospital are significantly reduced. Also, they're much less likely to pass the virus on to other people.
My first jab was nice and easy, no problem. My second one was a bit bruisy, felt a bit woozy for about a day or so, and I'm absolutely fine talking to you now here today.
You know, it's pretty treacherous, it's pretty disappointing. But should we expect anything different from somebody that's had a career like that clearly handed to him on a plate? A millionaire?
Well, I look at it and think, as well as you've got your establishment from the aristocrats, you've also got, I call them successful peasants, where I think they're very important in this, whatever it is. They might not understand quite what's going on because they're not part of the real plan and they never will be in the club, as the famous comedian said.
And make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. And by the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Man. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
But they are needed, because they will do anything that the controllers want them to, because all they're looking at is being successful. And we never get the offer. Well, we might have had the offer, but we've either it's been ignored by us, turned down or whatever, or it's gone straight over his head because we're not really tuned into that type of...
Like we've said before, Dom, that's why you'd get somebody young, because I don't know, if someone offered me a briefcase full of cash at 20-year-old, you know, and you didn't realise what you're getting involved in, would you have, you know, signed that deal at that age? Maybe you would. Maybe I would have done. I don't know. Yeah.
I think it's in stages as well, Chris, because they tie you in. I mean, like your work on the Beatles, Matt, and they don't, a 20-year-old, they haven't a clue what's going on. They just want to be pop stars, maybe. And so then
they might have laughed off that Faustian deal. You do realise, I mean, you do think, don't you, when you see some of these musicians, take Lionel Richie, for instance, like you always said, I'm still running around in his leather trousers and he's 80-odd, worth God knows how many millions. Is he doing that because at the beginning of his career, someone said, look, you've tried, you're in your, I'm guessing this, mid-20s or whatever. If you do this, we'll have you perform until you're 70 or 80 and you'll be world famous and you'll be worth millions. And he goes, fucking hell, right, I'm on, I'm in. But didn't realise that means he will be running around until he's 80 in his leather trousers. Yeah. You know, no disrespect to Lionel Richie, but he's got all the bells and whistles of a rich man. But what is the price of that? Is it just literally we'll be playing till he drops?
It makes you wonder with some of these DJs, because we spoke about Pete Tong in the last show, and I know that he did put in the graft for a number of years before he got onto Radio 1 and became famous. And Carl Cox worked very hard and slogged it out on the scene before he got all his riches and stuff. And then there's David Guetta, who became an absolute international megastar in sort of... 2008, whenever it was. And by that point, he'd been a DJ for like 15, 20 years, putting in the work. And there was a point where his career just went stratospheric. So it seems that some of these do get observed and noticed by the industry spotters and presumably made an offer that they just can't refuse.
I would say as well, Mark, that some of the older people who've been at it for years maybe are even more likely to be a successful peasant, like Dom said, because they've put it in and then I'll take an example. One I always thought, and I think he's a bloodline lineage fighter. George Clooney, for instance, he was an actor and he was a jobbing actor. He didn't become famous till I think he was in his mid to late 30s, which is not old, but he's old for an actor. And then all of a sudden he went stratospheric. And he looks like a man who's had his soul removed to me when you see him knocking around in real life. And his wife's very suspect, possibly. Whatever. But yeah, do you know what I mean? And he gets involved in UN and all that stuff. His missus is involved in it. What I mean is did he sign that deal a bit later? So he gave up more, kind of thing, if you know what I mean.
I read somewhere that he was CFR as well, Council of Foreign Relations. Is that true?
I haven't looked into him enough, but...
He got involved in all that political
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another suspect character is Fatboy Slim, Norman Cook. Started out as a member of the House Martins, this sort of indie pop group, and then he became an ambassador and pretty much the poster boy for the Ecstasy generation, as it, you know, under his Fat Boy Slim guise. He was always pictured with a smiley yellow face, and he was always pushing the idea of ease, and he was often seen chewing his face off as he DJed, you know. So for some reason, he was a chosen one, and he got married off to Zoe Ball rather in than me. BBC Radio 2 asset, you know. So you got some stuff on Fatboy Slim, right?
Yeah, I prefer the dad, Johnny Ball. I think he got struck off the BBC for questioning global climate warming change.
Did he?
I don't believe with David Bellamy, I think.
David Bellamy. Yeah, definitely. He vanished.
Bellamy did. I mean, he's not around anymore, David Bellamy, but I think Johnny Ball did as well. Fatboy Slim, yeah, he took violin lessons alongside or with Keir Starmer.
God's sake.
And his dad's an MBE environmentalist. Can't find any names of his father as an MBE. I will be able to find it, but I didn't have enough time to dig around. But he's an MBE environmentalist as his father. So, yeah.
So the thing is, you know, when you look at, you know, not just with the dance scene and Acid House, but any sort of thing that we've looked at over the years in music and entertainment, quote unquote, showbiz, you know, you say there Keir Starmer studied with Norman Cook, and someone might say to you, well, what's wrong with that? These things happen, you know, but when it keeps happening and keeps happening, it's always happening, isn't it? Whatever backstory we look at of these figures from the world of showbiz or entertainment or whatever you want to call it, the backstory invariably mentions somebody who went to school with somebody else who's connected to politics or intelligence services or whatever. You know,
nobody's dad is ever a plumber.
No, exactly. You never hear a backstory where, oh, Norman Cook grew up and he went to school. Left school, got a job. No, he went to school and his best friend was Keir Starmer or whatever. You know, it's always attached. The backstory is always attached to some kind of, elite, quote unquote, you know, figure or government or whatever. It's just gone beyond, you know, coincidence, hasn't it? It really, really has. It's a joke, really.
Well, again, Mark calls them lifetime actors. It's like you've got a set of people that go to school. It's like the Palumbos were all, they all went to Eton. So the Palumbos were all Eton. Again, not everybody at Eton is a chosen one. You know, there are people out there. I mean, you had a podcast with James Dellingpole. He was at school with a lot of these people. And he certainly jumped over the fence in recent times, hasn't he, Mark? Not everybody is poisoned.
School with Chris Whitty.
Chris Whitty. Chris Whitty.
Yeah. Oxford Uni with Boris Johnson.
Yeah, and David Cameron and Michael Gove and all these other people. Yeah. He was there. And just because you're there, you're not part of that because you're not in that club. They might ask you to come and do things for them, but if you turn them down, they won't keep asking you. You're out of it then. And some of these people will go along with it because it is career advancing, let's say. Mm. And it seems like some are chosen to do music like Fatboy Slim, some have chosen to go into politics, some go into architecture, some go into other forms of art, you know, but they're all there. It is like they're sleeper cells waiting to be called.
That's right.
That's what it feels like.
Controlling every propaganda tool available.
Yeah. 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 Every single thing is covered. They've got a sentinel in that area. It's like a contact, isn't it? We'll call them.
Well, I feel that's the case with Tim Westwood when it comes to the UK hip hop scene. He's often cited as a gatekeeper for that genre, which I believe he is. And also David Rodigan, MBE, with the reggae scene. Rodigan is the appointed gatekeeper of that whole situation.
Why are white people representing black music?
Exactly. Public schoolboys, you know, white public schoolboys from wealthy families spearhead these black music genres and represent an entire culture which isn't part of their own culture. So that's an alarm bell ringer.
How condescending and patronising.
The figurehead of Jazz FM is Jamie Cullum, who he's trying to be black. Well, he's more orange these days, but he's it's like an umpa-lumpa. But I mean, no disrespect to him, but he's like the face of English jazz music. I mean, Come on.
Really?
Yeah.
You could even take it further and say UB40 were out there as arguably the most prominent reggae band of the 1980s, and half that group is white, and Madness popularized ska, and they're all white. So you find it everywhere.
Elvis.
Elvis Presley, yeah. Yeah.
Rolling Stones, blues, you know, with their blues, you know, when they first started, yeah.
I mean, if you watch the Rolling Stones now, I looked at them for something I was looking into, and they've got the guy who was a proper soul singer, I'd forget his name now, who was a backing singer for the Stones on tour now, and you've got the lady there who can obviously sing 10 times better than Mick Jagger, if not 100 times. Both of them can sing, and without them, that live performance would be nothing. And they get no credit. They're not part of the Rolling Stones, yet they get that, who's the other guitarist, they get him. He wasn't even a member of the Rolling Stones. They brought him in the 70s. He's a
Ronnie Wood.
He's a full-fledged member. You know,
he was paid a wage when he first joined. If I'm not mistaken, when he first joined the Stones in '75, I think it was after Mick Taylor had left. Mick Taylor had replaced Brian Jones when he was kicked out. Effectively, I think it's safe to say he was kicked out. Then it was Mick Taylor after Brian Jones. And then after Mick Taylor, when he left, it was Ronnie Wood. Ronnie Wood was on a wage. So he was in the photographs. He was on the album covers. He was in the publicity photos. He was in, to the outside world, to the media, he was a member of the Rolling Stones. But when it came to pay grade, he was on a wage up until, what, the 2000s or something like that, when he finally began to get royalties from the albums and the songs and the tours that they keep doing. But yeah, he was on a wage for something like 30 odd years, even though he was a member. I mean, that's what sort of a band of brothers is? Oh, this isn't a band of brothers, is it, really? This is like a business arrangement.
Yeah.
It's quite cynical, really, you know.
Well, we're cynical guys, aren't we?
Yeah,
something called paranoid.
Another DJ I just wanted to home in on is Paul Van Dyke, who is of godlike status to his fans for his place in the trance scene. He's out of Germany. He was born in East Germany, Eisenhüttenstadt, which translates as tin roof town or something. I think my German is not too hot, but this was prior to the Berlin Wall coming down in the days of the Cold War, East Germany. And Dom, you're someone that does a lot of research. Do you get suspicious when you try to find information on somebody's father and there's absolutely nothing to be found anywhere online?
Yeah,
because that's the case with this guy. You can find lots of stuff about his mother, who's portrayed as raising him in a single parent household.
Knew you were going to say that.
But there's nothing on his father. We can't find anything about who his dad was.
Especially at that time in the 70s in Germany, East Germany. Your intelligence alarm bells start ringing because they have to do. It reminded me, his story reminded me of the Google guys. One of them, I think it's Sergey Brin. His father was a professor in the USSR. And they got permission to leave the USSR and basically go to the US. And Sergey Brin and the other one at Google both went to Stanford. And it sounded like Operation Paperclip years after the war. Why would the Russians allow a professor in the middle of the Cold War to leave with his family just to go to America?
And how does he get to Stanford?
And then he gets into Stanford, does Sergey Brin. And then they come up with, again, we talked about Stanford last time, but we come up with that. So it reminded me of that, where you can't really find a lot of information about their background. Fatboy Slim were the same. There's no, I couldn't find any information about his father, and he's an MBE. You'd have thought there'd have been a story about him.
Yeah. Nothing in their bios about
nothing. I mean, I've only had a quick scoot through, but nothing there jumps out straight away, which tells me they're trying to hide something.
Yeah.
I watched the video you sent us. Are we there? Because I don't know anything about these DJs, to be fair, Matt, but the video you sent about you mentioned about the butterfly symbolism. I mean, I watched that video.
For an angel.
Yeah, and he's got butterflies on his face. All
what kind of angel are we talking about?
Did you notice that later on in that video, or earlier on, he sat just outside this like shack with dark glasses on, and there's a little boy and girl playing football. I thought that was creepy. He's just sat staring at him with dark glasses on a chair. It's really weird.
There's a lot of creepy things. He talks a lot on his social media about pizza. Go figure.
Right.
There's one social media posting, a Facebook post, where he said, "Last night I dreamt of pizza, then I got pizza."
Oh, God.
For guys like us that research things,
that's creepy, isn't
that's not the kind of terminology you want to be throwing around out there.
I went on to one of his other videos after that, Max. Like I said, I'm not that familiar with him. And I swear, in this video, and I might be wrong, totally wrong, they sat on this like big couch, and this boy and girl are kissing quite graphically with their tongues, and it's quite like, whoa. And I might have this totally wrong. I think it's the two young kids who were in that original video, but they've got a bit older. But I might be wrong. That's what initially where I took from it. I thought that's creepy. First he's watching them, and then that's creepy. These two people kissing quite weirdly.
There's also a post where he's on a boat, looks like a Ibiza or somewhere, and he's got this toddler on the boat with him. And the caption that he's written is, "You've got to teach them young." And the thing about him is, he has no kids of his own. So that's not his kid.
That's the one thing I did think, thought, well, those two are his kids.
Yeah, he doesn't have kids.
Okay, I don't know.
It comes back to, who was it? Robert Louis Stevenson? I think it was. Anyway, who wrote Alice in Wonderland?
Oh, Lewis Carroll.
Lewis Carroll took pictures of Aldous Huxley's mother, Julia Arnold, and her sister when they were young girls. And he's obviously going back, you're talking 150 years or whatever. And that reminded me of that. And he got to a point where parents wouldn't allow the children to have a picture taken by Lewis Carroll.
Retro Peter.
And ironically, Lewis Carroll shares a similar bloodline to Aldous and Sir Julian Huxley of Edward III. I mean, do they know this? That's via his mother as well, Julia Arnold, who are having the pictures taken by.
And if you look at Alice in Wonderland, that ties into with a hallucinogenic kind of story. MKUltra, also acid, you could say LSD, you know, drink it, drink me, you know, in the story where she drinks from the special, you know, capsule or whatever it is and goes into this other world. And then you've got Aldous Huxley as well, who's the godfather of the 60s counterculture scene. So again, you have this kind of connection there.
This same record playing over and over again.
Yeah.
On just repeat. On repeat, yeah.
Yeah.
And that concludes episode 3 of Good Vibrations Exposés into the Second Summer of Love. Come back next time for the 4th and final episode in this series. We'll see you then. Good Vibrations.